All right, now I got it on. Okay, this week we're covering several chapters. Trouble at Home is what it's called. We're doing 2 Samuel chapters 13 through 16. So we're moving quickly through some of them. Trouble at Home. A family in trouble is a common occurrence today. I think you've all either had trouble in your own families. If not, you know some people who have. But it's never a pretty picture when there's trouble at home. There are two kinds of trouble that a family can experience. Trouble that comes from without, outside of the family, and trouble that comes from within the family. And though both can really be devastating, the more difficult of the two is trouble from within. External troubles, you know, when it comes from outside, they often pull a family together rather than separate. You know, you all kind of join forces against that external trouble, whatever it is. Trouble from within comes in the form of pressure, tension, abuse, neglect, unforgiveness, bitterness, heartbreaking hatred sometimes, and all other difficulties that accompany the carnal life when parents walk in the flesh, or when parents act foolishly, or when children respond in rebellion. Have any of that? Or when children respond in disagreement or even disharmony. So now today we begin to look at the downward trend in David's life. And as we go into these chapters, we're going to see that God took David through 8 steps of consequences pertaining to his sin. And the first step of consequence was marital infidelity. You all remember when we covered that before, the whole incident with Bathsheba and him committing adultery with her and then even murdering her husband. Well, after that incident, God had sent Nathan, the prophet, to tell Daniel, if you'll remember, that back in 2 Samuel chapter 12, he said, "The sword will never depart from your house." Well, God told me that. I'd start to tremble. I'd wonder what kind of sword and when is it coming, okay? But he told David that. And then again in chapter 12, he also sent Nathan to say to David, "I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to one who is close to you, and he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight." Whew, that's kind of... Now, if that were today and that was given, how many of us would say, that can't be a word from God, because God only gives uplifting, encouraging words. Okay? Excuse me a minute. It is warm in here now. I'm going to just open this one just a little. Not all of them.
Sure, is that the Holy Spirit here?
Yeah.
So, he gave David a really tough word, okay? So, Absalom, David's son, cohabitated with some of David's wives. And the grim account of that is found in 2 Samuel. Who has that first one? 16. Becky, go ahead and read 16 verses 20 through 22. Even though we're not in chapter 16 yet, I just want to see you to see something there.
So Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread, a skin of wine, and a young goat, and sent them with his...
No. Chapter?
Oh, sorry.
Are you in 2 Samuel?
My bad.
That's okay. There's a lot of Samuels around here. chapter 16.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm already prepared to. I marked it. Okay. There we go. 16, 20 through 22. Thanks for your patience, peeps. Okay. Okay, I got it right here. Oh, geez. Absalom.
Mm-hmm. Fifth row fell.
Give us your advice. What should we do? a fifth fell, answered, sleep with your father's concubines, whom he left to take care of the palace. Then all Israel will hear that you have made yourself obnoxious to your father, and the hands of everyone with you will be more resolute. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and he slept with his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel.
So, in my, I like in the NIV, it says here that that it would be a stench in his father's nostrils. A stench. Okay? So this, even though we jumped ahead here, I just wanted you to see where that fulfillment came to the word that Nathan gave to David. You know, and we will be, you know, in another time in that chapter, and you'll see how that all happened and why they were asking for advice. But this was the fulfillment of that. So think about it. I thought this was kind of interesting. Where did David first fall into sin? What was his first sin? Oh, come on, you all remember this one.
Not going to war?
No.
Okay.
Bathsheba.
Okay.
But where?
The porch. He was on the porch.
He was on the roof. Yes. He was on the roof looking where he shouldn't have been looking. And she was on the roof bathing where she shouldn't have been in full view. Okay. But I thought, does God have a sense of humor? I think about it sometimes. The whole thing began with him being on the roof. And so, how is he being repaid? By Absalom pitching a tent on the roof of the king's palace in daylight, and all his concubines, he's just bringing them to his tent in broad daylight in front of everyone in the city to see. I mean, yeah. So, but you might be thinking, hey, I thought David was forgiven for that sin of adultery. He was forgiven, but as you all know, God will forgive us, but there's still consequences. So David is entering the consequence stage now, even though God has forgiven him. God fits the consequences to the person, each one, tailor-made for us. David lived through such consequences. David has been forgiven, but his problems are not over yet. They're just beginning when it comes to consequences. In chapter 10, in chapter 12 last week, I'll just say this one sentence again. As part of the word Nathan brought to David, the rest of it, God said to him, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. So that whole word was not real warm and fuzzy, was it? Okay? So now we're going to start to enter into where some of this stuff happens. Now we come to the second step of consequence, and that was the loss of a child. In chapter 12, you'll remember what happened. Because of David and Bathsheba had entered into adultery, that God took that firstborn child, and on the seventh day after that, the child was born, the child died. Which added then to the grief of this forgiven man, David, who he had been forgiven, but he's now got this added grief of the loss of the child, and Bathsheba as well, the mother of the child. So they have the consequence of grief, okay? The third step of consequence, Carol, do you have chapter 13, verses 1 and 2?
Yes.
Would you go ahead and read those?
In the course of time, Amnon, son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, son of David. Amnon became frustrated to the point of illness on account of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it was impossible for him to do anything to her.
So Absalom and Tamar came from one mother, from the same mother. And wait, let me ask that correctly. Absalom and Tamar came from the same mother. Amnon came from a different mother and the same father. But better defined, what's going on here is incestuous lust. So Amnon, the brother, had incestuous lust toward Tamar, his half-sister. With the help of a friend, Amnon set up a scenario, a little scheme, to bring Tamar into his presence, where Amnon faked an illness, and he faked that he was sick, and then he let it be known that he wanted Tamar to bring him food. He could only have Tamar bring him food. He was so sick. And so they go through this whole long story that we don't have time to read all the verses, but basically that's what it was all about. She comes, you know, thinking she's, you know, going to help him, and she brings him food, but he really wants Tamar to lie with him, and she begs him not to do this. She says, please, do not do this. Do not do this. You know, I am a virgin. You know, you are a brother. Do not do this. Well, he didn't pay any attention to her, and in spite of her plea, he raped her. So in chapter 13, you got the whole story of how that, you know, that went on and how she was deceived. But then afterward, as soon as he was through raping her, Amnon, in verses 15 through 19 tells us that he hated her. He loved her so much before because it was lust. Now he hated her with a very great hatred and had his servants throw her out. So just imagine how she must have felt. First of all, she's been raped. And then all of a sudden, David says to her, he throws her right out of his room. Says, get out, get out, get out of here. I don't ever want to see your face again. Very, very, if you read all the verses, it was very nasty the way he did it and what he did. Then continuing in chapter 13, and verse 20, it talks about how in embarrassment and in disgrace, Tamar went to her brother Absalom, and she told him everything that had happened. Maybe she thought her big brother will stick up for her or something, okay? So she goes and she tells him everything, and he told her, he says, just be quiet for now. Don't tell anyone, don't say anything. Be quiet for now, and then don't take it to heart. Okay. Oh. So, I mean, when I read that,
I had to belt that out.
Kind of a brother is he? But he had his reasons, as we will see further on. He wasn't ignoring her. He was waiting to come up with a plan and a purpose. He was going to get revenge, but he was going to do it. He wasn't just going to fly off the handle now and run over and you know, get even with his brother. He was waiting for the right moment. But it sounds pretty like, man, if I had a brother like that, I would do without him. Okay? And then in verse 21, it says here, when King David heard all this, he was furious. Yeah, he should be, don't you think? Mm-hmm. But he didn't do anything. He did nothing. Here he is again, you know, passive father. Passive father. He was like that so much when the children were gone, and he was growing up, and he was gone all the time. You figure he's out to war, he's doing this and that in the kingdom. But he was passive. This is why he has some of the children that grew up the way they did. So he does nothing at this point. Obviously, he's kind of grieved about it, but he's not going to do a thing. Step four of the consequences. Brother hates brother. In verse 22 of this chapter 13, we're told, but Absalom never said a word to Amnon, either good or bad. You know, he's like, it never happened. For Absalom hated Amnon because he had disgraced his sister Tamar. So he's got a bone to pick with him. Lust has led to rape. Rape has led to hatred. You see the progression. Now hatred leads to the fifth step of David's consequences, murder. For 2 full years, this bitterness and this hatred ate away at Absalom. 2 years now have gone by. Now he hasn't forgotten what's happened. And as it continues in chapter 13, Absalom carries out a deceptive plan for revenge. See, he's been thinking all along, come waiting for the right moment. So in verses 24 through 26, he suggests a plan where he invites the king and all the king's servants to go to shear sheep together. It's a big event when they have the sheep shearing. And so he says, you know, come, you know, to my abode, and let's all go out and do the sheep shearing together, all my brothers and my father. But David tells Absalom, well, not all should go, lest we be too burdensome for you. Because just think of the huge entourage that would encounter. And it would be kind of a hardship maybe to put them all up and feed them. So, you know, David says, we don't want to be that burdensome on you. So instead, David blessed Amnon. No, I'm wrong. David blessed Absalom. I'm getting the two mixed up. And he says, well, my brother Amnon should go with me, though. David says, okay, he agrees. Now, if David had really been on top of things in his own household, he would have also known that Absalom had not spoken to Amnon for 2 years. Wouldn't you think that's a little odd? Like something's not right between the two brothers? Okay, and he would have been aware of this intense hatred that's brewing among some of his children. He had to know about that. Either that or maybe he was ignoring it, like he ignored the fact that Tamar had been raped. But when Absalom urged him to go, he says, you know, and let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. So now all the king's sons are going to go for the sheep shearing. And Absalom, on the side, he tells his men, he says, now when Amnon gets drunk with wine, kill him. So this is his plan. This is his revenge. So his men obeyed. After Amnon was slain, all the other king's sons fled because they all thought they're next. So they all took off. They're gone. They're hiding. So when it was first reported to David, it was told to him that all his sons had been slain. All of them. But then the corrected report came in and said, no, not all of them, only Amnon. And eventually the other sons returned when they saw that it was safe to return. They returned home. And here David is at home, and he's groaning under the ache of it all when he finds out that Absalom has fled. Now he's got one son dead, and another one of his favorite sons here, Absalom, took off, and he's in hiding. He's in rebellion. He has rebelled. So now we have step six of the consequences, rebellion. When Absalom fled, he went to Geshur. He went there because that's where his grandfather lived. Absalom's grandfather, that was his mother's father, on his mother's side, okay? And he was a king in Geshur. So Absalom went there to hide. And he stayed there 3 years. And he sets up a plan while he's there that later on is going to lead to a revolt against his daddy, a major revolt. In verse 39 of chapter 13, it tells us, it says, and the spirit of the king longed to go to Absalom, for he was consoled concerning Amnon's death. So in other words, David had finally come to the point that he'd forgiven the one son for killing the other son, and he's grieving. He's you know, been without his son for 3 years. He wants him back. But he doesn't know that Absalom is setting up this plan for rebellion. Okay? And that's exactly what he does in step seven. Seven of the consequences. Absalom now leads a conspiracy against his father. You see how the domino effect, one thing leads to another, to another, to another. Just from the one sin, it moved into the generations now, and it's affecting the whole family. Okay, would the reader read 2 Samuel 14, 1 through 3?
Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was toward Absalom. And Joab sent to Tekoa and fetched unto a wise woman and said unto her, I pray thee, feign thyself to be a mourner and put on mourning apparel and anoint not yourself with oil, but be as a woman that had a long time mourned for the dead. And come to the king and speak on this matter unto him. So Joab put the words in her mouth.
So he's going to do a little fraud here. So he gets this woman and he says, you know, we want you to look like you're really grieving. Go to the king and say what I'm going to tell you to say. So she goes to the king and she tells him a story that Joab told her to say. She tells him a story about a widow who had two sons, and one son had killed the other son. Now everyone wants the son that committed the murder handed over for justice. And in doing this, the heir of her husband would be snuffed out and none left to carry on his name. So she's given this big sob story, okay? But in verse 11 she says, let the king invoke the Lord his God to prevent the avenger of blood from adding to the destruction so that my son will not be destroyed. In other words, don't let justice, you know, take and kill my other son now because of what he did for our bloodline's sake. And the king replies, as surely as the Lord lives, he said, not one hair of your son's head will fall to the ground. So here the king is merciful. He's going to show mercy. He says, okay, you know. But the woman goes on to say to the king, does the king not convict himself? For has he not brought back his banished son? God does not devise ways, she continues, so that a banished, excuse me, does not God devise ways so that a banished person may not remain estranged from him? In other words, even God makes a way for the estranged to come back. Uh-oh, David starts to smell a rat here, finally. And he asks her if Joab, remember who Joab was, his commander-in-chief, you know, he asked her, has Joab had a hand in this? Has he talked to you about this? And she says, yes. So then David says to Joab, very well, I will do it. Go bring back Absalom. So now Absalom, who's been, you know, gone now for a couple of years, is going to come back like the prodigal son. So Joab brings Absalom back to Jerusalem. But he's not allowed to stay in the palace. He's got to go live on his own somewhere, and he is not allowed to see the face of the king. Because the king says, okay, he can come back and he can live here, but I don't want to see his face. Okay? He's not allowed in my presence. So Absalom lived in Jerusalem for 2 years without seeing the king's face. During that 2 years, two different occasions, Absalom goes to Joab, the commander-in-chief, and he requests, you know, he says, go to my father and see if I can have an audience with him. I want to talk to him. But both times, Joab said no. He would not take that request to the king. So Absalom sends his servants to go burn down Joab's barley fields. See, it's all about revenge. There's no end. One's got to do something to the other, and it continues and it continues. So Absalom burns down Joab's barley fields. Joab got the message. Finally, Joab goes to King David and puts the request, you know, your son Absalom wants to come and talk with you. He came and he bowed down, you know, with his face to the ground, and he kissed the king. So he put the request before him. So Absalom comes, does the same thing. Absalom bows down before the king. Absalom kissed his father. And after David forgives him, through a chain of events that Absalom worked out, he wormed his way to the king's doorstep, and he began to steal the hearts of the people. See, he's got a plan. He wants to take over the throne. He'd stand at the gate of the king, and the gate of the king, remember, is where the people would come each day and present their problems to the king, you know, what they needed help with or this or that, and the king would decide what was going to be done. But Absalom goes now, and he places himself at the gate to the king. And as people came to seek David's wise counsel, Absalom intercepted them. Oh, I'm helping my father here. You know, I'm going to relieve a little of the workload for him. So I'm helping him out. Tell me what your complaint is, and I'll help you. And then, you know, Absalom would hug them and kiss them, and he won their hearts, and he got them on his side. He said bad things about his father. All of them were false or exaggerated. And then he told them that their complaints were valid. Yeah, you've got reason to be complaining. They're valid and they're proper. But he says to them, but there is no representative of the king to hear them. He's lying. He says, if I were appointed judge in the land, I would make sure that everyone would get justice for their case. So you see how he's finagling here. He's sneaky. Okay, would the reader read 2 Samuel 15, 7 through 11?
At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, let me go to Hebron and fulfill the vow I made to the Lord. While your servant was living at Geshur in Arad, I made this vow. If the Lord takes me back to Jerusalem, I will worship the Lord in Hebron. The king said to him, go in peace. So he went to Hebron. Then Absalom sent secret messengers throughout the tribes of Israel to say, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron. 200 men from Jerusalem had accompanied Absalom. They had been invited as guests and went quite innocently, knowing nothing about the matter.
So then, Absalom sends for David's counselor, Ahithophel, okay, his advisor. He calls for him to join him as the conspiracy now gains strength and the conspiracy starts to increase. And before long, Absalom had the majority vote among the people. In verse 14, it tells us that a messenger now comes to David and tells him the men of Israel are with Absalom. Not good news. And David said to all his servants, arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us shall escape from Absalom. They'll wipe them all out because now he's taking over the throne. He's going to overthrow the throne. And of all things, David abdicates the throne. Okay, we got to get out of here now. So the king sets out with his entire household, and all of his mighty men are with him, and the whole countryside, as they're leaving, trying to go into exile somewhere, the whole countryside wept as all the people passed by, moving on toward the desert. They're heading out into the desert. There's not a whole lot of place to go around Jerusalem at that time, but the desert. Because once you got out of the city, that's all that there was. You know, very little, tiny little pockets of towns, but it was desert. And with David now, as he's leaving and he's going into exile, are Zadok and Abiathar. And I don't know if you remember from the past chapters that those are both Levite priests of David's. They're the top two top Levite priests. And they're carrying the Ark of the Covenant into exile with them. So David's not leaving without the Ark. Would the reader please read verses 25 and 26?
Then the king said to Zadok, take the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place again. But if he says, I am not pleased with you, then I am ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him.
Okay, think about this 1 minute. What a teachable, humble spirit David is showing once again. Why? He's saying, Lord, you choose what lies ahead for me. Whatever you say, I will accept. Okay? If you know, this is it for me and you want me dead, then so be it. But if you have a different plan for me, I'll just wait to hear from you. So he's humbled himself before God and he's willing to take whatever the consequences are. He also knows that the ark does not belong to him. He reveals here a real true understanding of the connection between the ark and God's presence with his people. The ark represents God's presence before the people. So if David takes it, he's thinking, you know, this isn't right. he knows that the possession of the ark doesn't guarantee God's blessing like a good luck charm. Remember how in the past they did that? They thought if they had the ark, they could go into battle and always win. It was like a good luck charm. They had forgotten the main purpose. And so David's thinking on these things, and he also recognizes that the ark belongs in the capital city as a symbol of the Lord's rule over the nation of Israel. If he takes it out of there, now he's just saying, well, that person that just stole the throne is ruling now over Israel. No, God still rules over Israel. So David's thinking all this. No matter who the king might be, David knows that ark needs to be there representing God's presence. So then David tells the two priests, Zadok and Abiathar, he says, take your two, your each of you take your sons and return to Jerusalem. And he will wait for them at the fords in the desert to hear from them. Okay, read verse 30.
But David continued up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. His head was covered and he was barefoot. All the people with him covered their heads too and were weeping as they went up.
So it's a sad scene, you know, the priest going away in exile. And now as David was coming to the summit on his travels here in exile, he meets Hushai. And Hushai comes to him and he's got a torn coat and he's got dust on his head. And, you know, that always meant somebody was either grieving or mourning. There were different reasons for that. So he comes in this condition. And in verse 37, it only tells us that he is David's friend. We don't know anything else about him except that David says Hushai is his friend. So now here comes his friend with dust on his head like ashes and his clothes torn. And what he's doing here is he's showing his compassion for his friend with this act. It's just like if your friend just lost someone that, in their family that died and they were grieving, and you want to show compassion to them, this was the way in the old days they would do that. So that's what he's doing here. He's showing compassion to his friend David. And David gives him, he wants to go with David. And David's saying, no, 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 you're not going to go with me. But he says, I have a special assignment for you. So he tells Hushai to return to the city of Jerusalem to be a spy for him. So that he's got some eyes and ears in the city. Now, he's got the two priests. He's got Zadok and Abiathar and their sons. And now he's got Hushai. So he's got some people in there to let him know what's going on. And he says anything that Hushai learns while he's there, to go to Zadok or Abiathar and tell them. And then they're going to get word to David. So they got a little spy ring going on. So Hushai arrived in Jerusalem just as Absalom was entering the city. Absalom is finally now coming into the city. Hushai goes to Absalom and he swears allegiance to him. See, he's a good spy. He swears allegiance to him and gives him all that bit. And Ahithophel, Absalom's advisor and chief counselor, is standing at his side when this happens. And so when David was told that Ahithophel was there, remember he used to be David's advisor, now he's there with Absalom, he's a turncoat, David prays all of a sudden, he says, oh Lord, turn Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness. And later on in the other chapters, you're going to see where that comes into play. The advice was total foolishness. So why did David pray that? Because back in verse 23, it told us, now in those days, the advice Ahithophel gave was like that of one who inquires of God. Just like the old time prophets, okay? And it says that both David and Absalom regarded all of his advice. So they believed that what he said, he had heard from God, and they better believe it. That's kind of how important that is there. So then in chapter 16, David continues in his exile, and he's met on the road now by Ziba. And Ziba was the servant of Mephibosheth. If you remember, Mephibosheth was the crippled grandson of King Saul, Jonathan's son, the only one that was a survivor. And David went and found him and brought him back into the palace and raised him there. He lived there in the palace. Well, here comes his servant now, Ziba. And Ziba has this big string of donkeys he brings, and they're loaded with 200 loaves of bread, 100 cakes of raisins, 100 cakes of figs, a skin of wine. It's like a huge banquet, okay? And he says they are a gift because he knows that David's people are in need right now because they're in exile. So he comes with this lavish supply. And David asks him, he says, well, where's your master's grandson? Where's, you know, Mephibosheth? And Ziba says, well, he stayed in Jerusalem because he thinks that he's going to be given back his grandfather's kingdom. He thinks that if he stays there now and he has an inn with Absalom, he's going to get back everything that was King Saul's that should have come down as the inheritance. So that's what he's and David replies, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours. Because, see, he's staying back there and he's betraying me now, but you have come and you've been generous, so everything that was his is yours now. Okay? But most likely, Ziba was lying, hoping to receive a reward from David, get in the good with him, get on the good side. So David believed Ziba's charge against Mephibosheth without even checking into it or even being skeptical. He just believed this.
Took his word for it.
He did. Now, he knew Mephibosheth for how long? He lived in this, took him into his palace, so he had to know the character of the man. He should have thought this through. It's even a message to us. Don't be hasty when he, don't be hasty to accept the accuser who may profit from another person's downfall. Be suspicious. David should have been skeptical of Ziba's comments until he checked them out for himself. So then what happens? You will find in chapter 19, which we'll cover next week, that David meets Mephibosheth. Mike, go ahead and read those verses, 25 through 30.
Chapter 19.
19, I'm sorry, yes.
Why didn't you come with me, Mephibosheth? The king asked him. Mephibosheth replied, my lord, the king, my servant Ziba deceived me. I told him, saddle my donkey so that I can go to the king. For as you know, I am crippled. Ziba had slandered me by saying that I refused to come, but I know that you are like an angel of God, so do what you think is best. All my relatives and I could expect only death from you, but my lord, instead you have honored me among those who eat at your table. So how could I complain? All right, David replied, my decision is that you and Ziba will divide your land equally between you. Give it all to him, as Mephibosheth said. I'm contentious to have you back again, my lord.
So you see what happened here? He gets another story now. He gets a different story from Mephibosheth, that Ziba lied to him also and then went and lied to David. So you have two different stories. And so David couldn't be sure at this point which one was telling the truth. So he just divided it between the two of them. They each get half of it. So he's, all the intrigues, the questions, comments. Anyone? No? Well, there's a lot more things in there, but we can only pick out so many, you know.
It just shows how creative the enemy can be.
Yes.
You know, and how he uses ordinary people to come in and deceive us. And if we're not right with the Lord, we can't pick that up.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. Carol.
I think it started also, David had more wives and concubines than he was supposed to have, so how is he ever going to keep on top of all what was going on?
Very good point.
My husband says he can't even keep up with just me.
Very, very good point, though. That is very true.
How do you keep up with all the ladies?
Yes. Well, next week we're going to I think, covered chapters 17 through 19. Sometimes it's hard to know exactly where we'll be in these, because until I start working on them, I'm not sure all the time how much material we can fit into a frame. So, yeah, Ed?
Yeah, one thing. If you just think about your own kids, I mean, how difficult is it to raise them and build into them you and your values? And if you're away from them, like absent fathers today, let's say, might be away because they're working, that's not built into those, and the children can grow up dysfunctional. Well, he had lots of children, and he wasn't raising. And they grew up, well, who did they grow up? They grew up according to the values of the mother, because he had a lot of different mothers that he was married to. There was just natural, mm-hmm. Jealousy, fighting going on. And this is all part of the way in which he chose to do it. Remember going all the way back when God just chose, don't intermarry, don't do this, don't mingle. All these probably came from non-Jewish women. Mm-hmm. Probably a lot of them.
Yeah.
And so it's almost, you could almost forecast this was going to happen. And so you had rape and murder and just rebellion.
It's interesting how many consequences there were. It's like there wasn't just one. I mean, you would have thought that just the baby dying would have been enough consequence, right? But then the things continued more and more, because the sin had passed down, you know, it was affecting the sons. And so it's working through in their lives, and they're allowing the sin then in their lives to just keep the consequences rolling, so to speak. Lynn?
Well, that was the culture, too. It wasn't God's plan to have all those wives.
Right.
It wasn't accepted in the culture.
Right.
And, you know, so right there, they hadn't, you know, he was a man after God's own heart, but yet he wanted part of that same culture.
He bought into it. Got, at some point, we don't know where or how, it doesn't tell us at what point in his life, he all of a sudden decided that it'd be okay to have a whole bunch of wives, even though God said not to. We don't know if, like us today in our culture, we might start out one way, you know, like, oh, Lord, I'm not going to watch anything on TV that's really not good for my eyes to see. Well, we start to move the boundaries sometimes little by little. Well, you know, well, this one's not quite so bad.
And then we start getting desensitized.
And what happens? It moves, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. The boundary moves. And so somehow I think this happened in a process over time. You know. Okay, next week, 17 through 19.